S-I-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba.
Let me in.
Shiba, shiba.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiba, shiba.
Open up your soul.
Shiba, shiba.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or when it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. It's the first Monday of the month, and that means I have my science envoy du jour here to talk about this specific brand of science that you all are going to fall in love with. I'd like to welcome Matt Tao. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Going great. How about you?
Pretty good. Yeah, SF is pretty hilly, so yeah, I just got done biking over here. But
where do you live? Were you not?
I live in Berkeley.
Oh, so you were expecting like a nice flat kind of surface?
I know how hilly the Bay Area is, but yeah, got my workout in today.
Well, excellent, excellent. I'm glad that you're able to do it. A lot of people, they look at it and they go, oh, that's a hilly city. I don't think I'll go. So, well, congrats. So before we get into the science portion of it, tell me, when did you first realize that you liked science?
Yeah, it's kind of a continuous journey that I didn't really kind of know when I exactly liked it, but mm-hmm. I just knew that I liked understanding the world mm-hmm. and figuring things out
and how old
learning
were you?
Things. I mean, middle school, high school, you know.
Okay.
I kind of was gravitated towards math and science, things like that. But, you know, I really didn't know what I wanted to do mm-hmm. with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of got to college and grad school. You know, I started taking these freshman physics classes, and I had this awesome professor who was just, he was really great in the way he communicated, like, the physics
mm-hmm.
and how he'd made me see kind of like the interconnections and kind of the beauty of being able to unite a few simple concepts and getting some emergent complex behavior out.
What does that mean? Emerging complex behavior?
Yeah. So in my worldview, mm-hmm. that kind of means that you have something that's composed of very simple kind of elementary building blocks, you know, like, for example, atoms are kind of the building blocks of our world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you put them together in really complex ways or in different ways, you get some really amazing kind of unexpected emergent behavior.
Like what?
For example, like the electronics we have in this radio station,
mm-hmm.
the blue sky that we see every morning, the warm cup of coffee we drink.
Okay.
Right? So all these things are connected by the same thing. But they all have really different properties that we all experience and kind of interpret in different ways. So mm-hmm. that's what I mean by kind of emergent, complex.
It almost seems sort of philosophical that the approach to physics, does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I mean, people have different ways of tackling things, right? Mm-hmm. My worldview is, you know, you should appreciate the beauty of it, and also it helps you figure out how to use it for other things.
Okay, okay. So you have this really inspiring instructor in college
yeah.
that sort of lit a fire in your brain.
Yeah, yeah. I just, from that point on, I really got addicted to physics.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, just being able to figure things out and explain a lot of phenomena. Yeah.
Okay, so after after you have this torch goal, you know, or this realization that, physics, then how do you know, like, do you study all of physics, or do you get sort of channeled into one specific, like how did you find out what your path was?
Yeah, so my path was actually kind of tumultuous in that way. I just, after taking that physics class with my freshman physics professor, I just knew that I wanted to do physics. I didn't really know what kind of physics or what that looked like, you know. I just started taking a lot of physics classes, trying to get involved in research at my undergrad institution.
Mm-hmm.
And it is difficult for, I know how difficult it is for undergrads to try to find something that suits their needs, because it's a whole different world and you kind of don't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important that there's good mentors out there to kind of guide people and kind of give them the opportunity to explore, even if it doesn't work out in the long term.
Oh, okay. And you've obviously found a good mentor, otherwise we wouldn't be talking today.
Yeah. I found some good mentors, you know. I tried out different labs in my undergrad. I tried out some biophysics stuff. I tried doing some fluid mechanics stuff, which basically means that you kind of model water or fluid-like materials in a way and see what happens.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I tried some accelerator physics at Cornell for a summer.
What's that?
What is that?
Is that like bouncing atoms in a giant tube or something?
Something like that.
Okay.
But the basic idea is you have this metal vacuum chamber, and inside this metal vacuum chamber, you want to accelerate charged particles to very high speeds. So, for example, at the LHC, or Large Hadron Collider, they do exactly this. So they have a special kind of mix of electric and magnetic fields to accelerate these particles to near light speed. And so the stuff I was working on was kind of instrumentation or tools to kind of diagnose those kinds of technologies.
Okay. So you dabbled in the biological physics, you dabbled in accelerator physics.
Yeah.
And when, like, what did you finally land on? Like, what was the thing that made you went, aha?
I don't think I've had that aha moment until kind of recently in my graduate school career. Kind of maybe a couple years ago, when I joined my professor's group and kind of stuck with it. I've learned a lot and I'm really excited about the science we're doing.
What is the science that you're doing?
Yeah, the science that I'm currently doing with my professor is we're taking very ultra-cold atoms, and we're using them as measuring tools to probe gravity and things possibly beyond gravity.
Okay. I've never really thought of atoms as having a temperature. I thought that they just sort of moved and it was their movement that created, so explain to me cold atoms.
Yeah. So if you think about temperature or hot and cold, what you usually think of is like the cup of coffee you have in the morning, right? That's really hot.
In my ice water, in my isolated mug. That's
or
really
yeah,
cold.
Or if you have a ice latte or something. But the concept of hot and cold comes to the notion of temperature, like we were talking about. And in physics, if you zoom in deep enough, you can eventually look at, for example, the liquid in your coffee and see that it's basically just a bunch of atoms jiggling around and bouncing off each other.
Okay.
So the temperature we actually perceive is basically how fast these atoms are moving.
Okay.
And more accurately, it's the spread in how fast they're moving. So if I have a bunch of atoms, let's say I have a fan, and I spin this fan, and all the atoms are moving at like 10 feet per second in my room.
Okay.
That doesn't correspond to a hot temperature. Something that's hot has a large spread in velocities. So, for example, in the cup of coffee, there's a lot of atoms that are moving super fast and also super slow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So then what you're saying is a cold atom is just sort of meandering along, or is it not moving at all? Or
So a cold atom would be basically you have a bunch of atoms, let's say a million atoms, that are all moving, for example, near like 3.5 millimeters per second. So they're all averaged around that velocity.
Okay. And so you experience it temperature-wise as cold. Yes? No?
Well, we don't actually touch the atoms and freeze on impact.
Right. but if you were to experience it, would it feel cold?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the notion of hot and cold just basically also means how fast the energy may be transferred from one body to another.
Okay.
So if I have these atoms and they're moving super slow, and if I have my hand, which if you zoom in, the atoms that make up me are moving really fast compared to those cold ones. And if I touch those cold atoms, they'll get the energy really quickly and heat up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you're studying these cold atoms because...
Yeah, we're studying these cold atoms because we believe they're a good tool to perform measurements and to find out more about our world. So in the past, measurement comes down to basically you have a physical quantity you want to observe. For example, how fast something moves, how hot something is, how much force something exerts.
Okay.
And then you have a measuring device, which obeys the same physics.
Okay.
So you come up with this measuring device and you have some kind of mathematical equation that dictates how the measuring device will act under a certain kind of load. For example, you know, if I have a scale and I put an apple on it, I know that the scale will kind of decompress if it has a spring. And depending on how strong the spring is, then I can determine the force of the apple.
Okay.
Depending on how strong the spring is.
Okay. So how will you use these cold atoms to measure things? I mean, what niche is it filling?
So the niche we're targeting is basically we want to find out more about gravity.
Okay.
So gravity is one of the oldest and most well-known forces in our universe, dating back to, you know, Isaac Newton. So Newton had this model of gravity, which follows this inverse square law and was shown to be very accurate for its time.
What's the inverse square law for those of us who had a very bad science teachers growing up?
So the inverse square law basically means if you have, imagine you have two spherical balls, right?
Okay.
And they're a distance apart in space. Let's call it 1 meter apart.
Okay.
So you have these balls that are 1 meter apart, and they have some force of attraction.
Okay.
And if you move them further apart, let's say now they're 2 meters apart.
Okay.
That means the force between them is cut down by a factor of 1/4.
Okay. Okay.
So that's the inverse square law. But So basically, the closer you are to something, the stronger the force. The further you are, the force drops off pretty strongly.
Okay. By a square root of... Okay.
By 1 over r squared.
Okay. So you explained that, and now you're explaining what you're using your cold atoms to measure.
Yeah. So I'm giving some background on gravity, right? So we have this pretty good model of gravity. Then Einstein comes along and gives us an even better model of gravity, general relativity.
Okay.
And so his theory is basically there's a notion that not only do you have this attraction between the objects, but this attraction is actually because when you place this ball in this manifold or this carpet we call space-time, when you place this ball in this space-time, it actually deforms space-time.
Yeah, that makes sort of like when you...
trampoline kind of analogy. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so if it deforms, are you using the cold atoms to measure that deformity, or are you... What are you using?
To an extent.
Oh, okay.
Except in the regime we're currently at, we can't exactly measure that curvature, right? What we're trying to measure is deviations from Newton's gravity.
And are there a lot of deviations?
Not that we can see.
Oh, okay.
which is a good thing and also maybe kind of disappointing for us physicists.
Okay.
Disappointing because it's exciting when we discover something new, something strange, right?
Sure, sure, sure.
That means there's more out there.
Okay. So currently what you're saying is Newton's theory is pretty stable and you haven't found any exceptions to it yet?
Not quite yet.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, the motivation for using atoms, you might ask the question, why use atoms? You can probably measure gravity between objects with something simpler, like a big ball and some other apparatus, which you can. But the motivation for using atoms is because they're quantum mechanical in nature.
What does that mean, quantum mechanical in nature?
Yeah, quantum mechanical basically means, so in physics, we make this delineation between classical and quantum.
Okay.
In the classical world, objects behave according to our intuition. For example, a chair is a chair, and it doesn't act like a wave, right? It's a solid object. But in the quantum world, if an electron, for example, is sitting on a hill, right?
Okay.
And it's sitting in the bottom of a hill, and this hill kind of has two sides to it.
Okay.
It's in the middle of two peaks.
Yeah, like in a valley.
Yeah, it's like in a valley.
Okay.
So in the quantum mechanical world, the electron can actually go through the hill and kind of tunnel through this hill
without
an escape.
Without harming the structural integrity of the hill?
Yeah.
Oh. Now, what does quantum mean in physics?
Yeah, quantum has a kind of a few different notions. So in the 1900s, people were exploring this phenomenon known as black body radiation. And this guy named Planck had this notion, or was trying to figure out exactly the kind of energy density of black body radiation.
What's black body radiation?
So black body radiation is basically the light that emits from a really hot object.
Oh, okay.
So whenever you burn wood, you're seeing a lot of black body radiation.
The flames.
Yeah, the flames.
Okay,
the flames.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So Planck wanted to come up with this solution to how much energy is actually contained in this black body spectrum. Like for a certain temperature of the wood, like for example, if it gets to 200 degrees Fahrenheit, the wood will emit all kinds of light. And he wants to figure out how much energy is contained within this light.
And why do you want to know that?
Why do you want to know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I don't know exactly why they wanted to figure that out, but I think it was for the purposes of like figuring out how much energy you would need to power some kind of bulb or something.
Okay, so there was a practical application to this theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know everything about it.
No, but
yeah.
Yeah, it's like
something along those lines.
Because sometimes you think, why did someone decide to like, it would never occur to me, like, how much energy is this piece of wood putting out?
Yeah,
but then it's
yeah.
like, well, if we can figure out how much energy is wood versus, like, I guess a metal or this or that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay.
So there are some practical considerations, but more or less, you know, physicists just want to figure stuff out.
Sure, sure, sure. So we've got that. So, and that's a classical thing.
Yeah, it was believed to be classical. But then Planck kind of had this kind of ad hoc fix. Basically, he kind of said, oh, if I try this, if I say that light can only emit in packets of specific frequencies, then this equation kind of works.
You mean like when you break them into like the prisms, like when you break up light, bands of light? Is that what, when you talk about the frequencies?
I'm talking about...
Can you tell I'd had very little science education?
No, this is great. Yeah, yeah. What I mean is Planck said, okay, let's say light emits energy in these specific kind of packets called photons. Well, not photons. Planck didn't say that. But he said, what if we quantize this quantity? And what he found was that from quantizing the light, you could get this kind of nice closed-form solution that matches experimental conditions.
Okay.
that was a kind of a long answer to the question of what is quantum. But quantum, there's kind of a few notions. Basically, light has both matter and wave characteristics. Also, matter has wave characteristics, right? And also that things are kind of discrete. There are discrete packets of states that certain physical objects can occupy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So quantum is about discrete packets?
Yeah, yeah. One aspect of it, yes.
Okay. And can it be any size, or does it have to be...
specific packets, specific energy levels.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And is that specific energy... So you're saying quantum physics is... If you remove the word quantum, you could replace it with energy physics?
You could or replace it with kind of discrete or kind of... maybe the word is...
microscopic or...
Microscopic is also good.
Yay me!
So when you zoom in, we find that the quantum physics behaves really differently.
I've heard that. It's like all bets are off when you get on to that super tiny level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's classical and there's quantum.
Yes.
You're drawn to the quantum.
I'm drawn to physics.
Okay. But currently, are you doing...
I'm doing quantum physics. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So when you first got into quantum physics, mm-hmm. what were some of the things that kind of challenged your understanding of how things worked?
Yeah. When you're first introduced to quantum in like your classes or in certain textbooks that you read, it is very weird and abstract.
Uh-huh. And what was like something you were like, that's weird. That can't possibly be true, but it is.
Well, one thing I kind of wasn't used to at first was this concept of spin that electrons have.
Okay. Elaborate.
Okay. yeah, spin. So spin, basically, it's an intrinsic property of these fundamental particles we have, like protons, neutrons, electrons.
I learned those, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And so these fundamental particles, they kind of have this intrinsic angular momentum. And it's really odd because we treat them as point particles in our classes. Basically, what I mean by point particle is that it's infinitely small, infinitesimally small. So mm-hmm. you can imagine it's as close to the smallest thing as you can get. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by point particle.
Okay.
And the strange thing is, if you have this kind of point particle, you really don't have anything to spin. So if you imagine you have a top, mm-hmm. you can spin this top on a table and it's spinning, mm-hmm. right? But this notion of spin for these point particles, it shows up in all the physics that we do. Experimentally, we see it. But as for how to imagine it exactly in our heads is a mm-hmm. bit mysterious.
But so if you're going deeper and deeper and deeper and it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, I mean, just because it's small, why would its size mean that it can't spin around?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like in, for example, like what you just mentioned, as you get smaller and smaller and smaller, some of these particles actually do have some kind of finite size, like mm-hmm. the protons and the neutrons. They're made of other particles. Mm-hmm. And so those particles, you can imagine they could spin. Mm-hmm. But as far as we know, we believe electrons to be fundamental particles that you cannot divide anymore.
Okay.
And in our models of physics, we treat them as like points, something that doesn't even have any finite extent. So... it's hard to even imagine that in the real world, right? Because even if we have a really tiny dot on a piece of paper, mm-hmm. it still has some kind of area mm-hmm. on that paper.
So you're saying it's so small that it almost doesn't have any area?
And, yeah.
And because it doesn't have any area, you're not expecting... But then isn't it just... It's too small for us, but it still has I mean, it exists, so it,
yeah,
so it can still turn.
It could. I really can't say.
Oh, no. But that just, like, that messed with your head for a while.
Yeah. It messed with my head, yeah. And then what else? Let's see. Something that still messes with people's heads is, like, superposition and entanglements.
Now, I've heard of that, but I don't remember what it is. So explain those concepts.
Yeah. So if you imagine you have, let's say you have an electron, right? It has a spin.
Okay.
So this electron can have a spin up or down.
Okay. This way or okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So imagine you start with the electron with its spin kind of pointing up. So you turn your top and it's spinning counterclockwise.
Okay.
And then let's say you apply some kind of special light pulse
mm-hmm.
to get this electron into some kind of superposition.
And what's superposition?
Yeah. I'll explain that in a moment.
Thank you.
So you apply this specific light pulse to get this electron into a superposition of spinning up and down.
Okay.
And so what superposition means, it makes much more sense in a kind of mathematical language.
Mm-hmm.
But what superposition means is that the state of your quantum mechanical system is expressed as a sum or some kind of combination of the states the quantum system can occupy. So in the case of the electron, the states it can occupy are up and down.
Okay.
And so a good quantum state can be, okay, my quantum state equals electron up plus electron down.
Is that because because that's how it behaves, or is it that because you don't know where it is?
That's a good question. It's a bit of both. Like, this question is still bugging physicists as far as I know.
Okay.
So this superposition question, we call it kind of an ontological problem, kind of physical interpretation problem.
Okay.
And so this is what makes classical versus quantum mechanics a bit more wacky, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, your chair is there.
Mm-hmm.
Your chair is there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not
in three places at the
same
time.
In three places at the same time, right? And when you can spin your chair, right? You,
mm-hmm.
you've got a nice little rolly chair.
Mm-hmm. I do.
So you can spin your chair, and you can only spin it one way, right?
Well, you have to stop and try and
You'd have
it.
To stop
yeah,
it,
yeah, yeah.
right? You can't spin it both ways at the same time.
True.
But with quantum mechanics, the math says you can kind of spin it both ways at the same time?
Wow. I'm just now getting it.
Oh,
is
okay.
that part of that two opposing things are happening at the same time?
Yeah.
Seemingly, and you're like, how can that be?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, and it's driving everyone nuts.
Yeah, it still drives everybody nuts, but you know, physicists kind of choose to ignore the kind of physical interpretation of the problem.
Okay.
I think it's very important. So there's a few problems with quantum mechanics that we still haven't figured out. And this is one of the, I don't know the formal name, but let's just call it the ontological problem.
Sure.
Yeah, the interpretation of what this actually means.
But I love that there are these things in physics that people are just going, what's going on? But they still power through. Like,
yeah.
Like, but how do you, with these things that you can't figure out, how do you move forward from that and design things that help you understand what's going on when you can't even wrap your head around the fact that it's doing two things at the same time?
Yeah. Sometimes you just have to kind of put your head down
just accept it?
A bit. In the
okay.
presence of these problems. You
okay.
know, you can there's two ways to accept it. You can accept it and move on and never think about it again. Or you
uh-huh.
can accept it and say, we'll figure this out later, I think.
But so to be clear, these are things that they know are happening or that they believe are happening on the quantum level. Ability to spin up and down at the same time.
We're pretty sure it's happening.
Okay.
But we don't know how to interpret it in like human classical language. That's the thing. So, you know, we grow up in a classical world. We grow up with things being in only one place at once or mm-hmm. doing one thing at once.
Mm-hmm.
So to translate that into, you know, our big human senses,
yeah,
it almost doesn't make sense. So I think
you kind of have to be like a kid and just, you know, like,
a bit.
You know, because with kids, it's like all things are possible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it could be that there's no good answer to this
mm-hmm.
and we just have to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm assuming that you're of the I'm going to put my head down and just assume that we'll figure it out at some point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do your work.
Exactly, yeah. And
which, what is your work?
Yeah, my work is deeply related to the superposition states.
Okay.
So what we do is we take atoms,
mm-hmm.
these ultra-cold atoms, and we're able to apply a special light pulse,
mm-hmm.
a series of light pulses, to put these atoms into what we call a spatial superposition.
Okay.
So not, it's different from the example I gave before,
sure,
where the
sure.
electrons are spinning both up and down, kind
right.
of, at the same time.
Because I have heard that there's that thing where they can occupy several positions at once.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that was, is that the spatial concept? It's like,
if we're talking
here,
about the same
here.
Thing, I think so.
Okay.
So what we do is we apply these laser pulses.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine you're tossing a ball up,
mm-hmm.
we can split that ball into two places at once.
Okay.
So one, so imagine you throw a ball up and then you apply some laser pulse. And then all of a sudden the ball splits into two parts.
Mm-hmm.
So the ball splits into two parts with one part going up faster
mm-hmm.
and the bottom part going a little bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
And then we apply another laser pulse to get two balls that are traveling at the same speed, but just separated in space.
That's crazy. It's almost like, you know, when they talk about the different timelines, it's almost like you're splitting up their timelines. So it's like, we've got that one there and this one here and this one. We can see them all at once.
It's a little bit like that. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's very cool. And so when you are aiming these, what's the ultimate goal for this?
Yes, the ultimate goal is using these atoms as a measuring device.
Right.
And so what our ultimate goal is to improve our measuring device such mm-hmm. that we can measure gravity very precisely from a variety of objects. For example, some recent work we did was to put these atoms into the special superposition state.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to measure the gravity of a tungsten cylinder very precisely with these atoms.
Okay. And
what I mean by gravity is the... So we talked about gravity earlier, right? Newtonian
mm-hmm.
gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So everything in the world has this attraction. So the mic I'm talking into and me have some kind of gravitational force between us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a billion times weaker than another force, the electromagnetic force.
Sure, sure, sure.
So it's very hard to measure in the presence of other forces that are flying around.
Got it. Okay. Like everything has
yeah.
some sort of attraction, some sort of weak attraction, and
yes.
you're trying to like get that down to zero so you can just know sort of the absolute.
Well, everything has the weak attraction like you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
but there's other forces that can kind of wash out that weak attraction that you're trying to measure.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to measure that weak attraction, gravity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. And why is that important to get that exact measurement?
Yeah, it's important because we want to figure out if there's any deviations from Newton's theory of gravity
right.
or Einstein's theory of gravity.
And you say it isn't so far there isn't.
Yeah,
correct.
So far there isn't.
But is there a theory that there probably is somewhere and you just haven't seen it yet?
Oh, there's a bunch of theories.
Oh.
Way too many.
Okay. Okay. And so you guys are just like open, like let's kind of like weed these out. Let's see what we can find out.
Yeah, so there's kind of two aspects to physics. There's theoretical physics where
mm-hmm.
people kind of make toy models and try to figure out, okay, if we have this kind of weird particle in the universe, will this cause any changes in what we see?
Mm-hmm.
And then experimentalists are of the camp of building tools and building apparatuses to test physics.
But that's great because you need both, because you got the people who are like generating ideas.
Yeah.
What about this? And then the other person on the other side is like, yeah, what about that? Let's see what we can build. Let's see if we can figure that
out. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then there's like, no, that didn't work. Oh, well, what about this? I love that, that you, like, you need each other. You're like a Reese's peanut butter cup, but in science.
Yeah, I mean, physics is about the real world, right?
So, yeah, yeah.
If we're all doing math, then nobody's actually testing the real world.
Right. You're very good at explaining things. So I'm looking at your bio and it says that you're passionate about learning and teaching. So do kids come up and pepper you with questions?
Yeah. When I have the opportunity to talk to kids, I try to distill things down to the simplest way you can explain it. Because I believe if you cannot explain it in a simple way, then you don't truly understand it.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you would lose the kids, too, because...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I wish I'd had a that kind of science teacher growing up that, you know, really wanted to, you know, make it understandable.
But yeah, thanks.
Sometimes people aren't trained to teach science, so... And they're assigned as
certainly
science teachers.
Certainly not. Yeah.
So you were very fortunate to have had good teachers and good mentors.
Yes, yes, yes.
So where's the lab that you work at?
The lab is at UC Berkeley.
Okay.
So I work under Professor Holger Mueller.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very cool. Very
and we
cool.
specialize, basically to sum up our lab, we do fancy experiments with lasers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a real privilege to work with the group and learn so much from them. And, you know, before I went into grad school, I was really good at math and stuff and science. And I really had no, like, practical skills to build things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after working with them for a couple years, it's, mm-hmm. yeah, it's kind of amazing how fast you can learn all these skills and become pretty competent.
Very good. Well, with that in mind, if people want to know more about what you and your lab are doing, how do they go about finding that out?
Yeah, you can look up my professor.
Which is, again?
Holger Mueller. So that's Holger Mueller at UC Berkeley.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you can find our webpage and you can find my contact, too, if you have questions.
And if there was like a kid or, you know, an adult who didn't have great science, who wanted to understand it better, is there a book or a show or anything that you would recommend? And you'd say, this is actually pretty good at explaining some basic concepts around quantum physics.
So there's one book I read recently. It's called Quantum, funnily uh-huh. enough. It's by Manjit Kumar, I believe, is the author.
Okay.
It's a good background about the history of quantum mechanics. And it tells a good story about how it was developed and kind of the complexities behind it and the ideas and what people were thinking of at the time. So that's a good kind of introduction to quantum and its history and why it confuses people.
All right. Well, we're out of time. And I could pepper you with questions forever. But Matt, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
And if people want to follow you, how do they go about doing that?
You can go to my professor's webpage.
So it has to be the professor's. They can't stalk you on the down low. Got it.
I mean, I don't have like a science Twitter or something, but maybe gotcha. I should make one. Coming soon.
Okay. Well, Matt Tout, thank you again for being on the show.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, people of Earth, there were a lot of concepts in there that, you know, you hear thrown around a lot, and now you actually learned what they are. So that is great. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with some performers, and it's going to be so much fun.
Parietal, frontal, temporal, occipital. Parietal, frontal, temporal, occipital. Those are the four lobes of my brain, seated below my cranium, working to make my body work, tied by the basal ganglion. The frontal lobe helps me with my problem solving, provides motor skills along with critical thinking. The parietal, handwriting and sensation. Don't forget word skills, it's helping write this song. Parietal, frontal, temporal, occipital. Parietal, frontal, temporal, occipital. Those are the four lobes of my brain, seated below my cranium, working to make my body work, tied by the basal ganglia. The occipital processes everything visual. The V1 cortex is doing most of the work. The temporal does memory and hearing, gives me emotions, it helps me get what you say. Parietal, frontal, temporal, occipital. Parietal, frontal, temporal, occipital. Those are the four lobes of my brain, seated below my cranium, working to make my body work, tied by the basal ganglia.
Hey, what about the cerebellum?
I don't know. What should we tell him?
Balance and coordination.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That was the Dandy Sounds and Below My Cranium from Brain Beats. We had our scientists on, and there are people in this world who are defying physics and gravity from the Flux Vertical Theater. I'd like to welcome a cadre of people who are here to talk about a show that they are currently doing. How's everybody?
Good.
Awesome.
Doing wonderful.
Thank you for having us.
Excellent. So we've got Joshua Kaplan on the line. Let me allow you to introduce yourselves and your particular specialty within this Flux Vertical Theater. So we'll start with Josh.
Hello, yes, my name's Josh Kaplan. Marilyn does know my name because I do want to say she has known me pretty much my entire life.
I have.
Super happy to be on the show with her.
Awesome.
I am playing a character in the production of Crimson Cabaret named Frankie Bills. He is the money man and the finance behind this amazing club.
Okay. Next up, Miss Kay.
Hi, my name is Ms. Kay, and I am one of the co-owners, producers, directors, writers, choreographers, and performers in the show, and I play Viola Vavoom, who is a fallen starlet from Broadway, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And last but...
And like I said, I helped write the show and direct and do all the things with Leah.
Go ahead, Leah.
Hi, I am Leah Marie, and yes, I am also the co-owner, director, choreographer, photographer, dancer. And my character is Rose, and she is the damsel in distress, I would say.
Very cool. Mm-hmm.
And so, the wife of Frankie Bills.
Okay.
Yes.
So my first question is, how long has the Flux Vertical Theater been around?
Well, we started
a little over, like, almost 10 years. But
wow.
We've just been performing mostly in the Bay Area and beyond.
Yeah. We started as a dance company.
Go ahead, Kirsten.
Yeah, no, we started as a dance company, and we, like Leah said, we've been around for going close, I think maybe more around, like, I don't know, 9 years. And then when COVID hit, mm-hmm. Leah and I lost our place to train and rehearse.
Mm.
So we had this crazy idea to open this space, and The space itself has been open how long now, Leah? A little over a year and a half.
And where is
it? Took a year and a half to build it.
And where is the space? Where's the space?
We are in Berkeley at 811 University Avenue.
Okay.
Right off the highway. Super convenient with a parking lot. And we're super happy to be there.
And Josh, how did you get involved with this crew?
So I got involved with this. I've worked with Miss Kay and Leah in different shows, you know, helping them with acts, doing a lot of setup and, you know, dragging equipment out for them. And they reached out to me a couple months ago asking if I would be interested in joining Crimson Cabaret, the production. And
very
just
cool.
Utterly amazed. I am overwhelmed and awed at their talent and the talent of the rest of the cast. So I jumped at the opportunity to be a part of something so incredible.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about Crimson Cabaret. And I'm going to, this one should come from the person who came up with the title.
Oh, well, that's both of us.
Okay.
So yeah, then... I'll tell you a little bit and then let Leah talk about it. So, Leah, do you actually want to go ahead and talk about your photography series? Because that's kind of where it came from.
Leah? Oh, looks like Leah Oh, here she is. Leah, why don't you go ahead?
Do you want to tell them about the photo series that this was inspired from?
Yeah, so I had a concept a couple years ago to do a film noir, very edgy, black and white murder story.
Mm-hmm.
And just doing it all through triptychs, which are basically a series of three photos.
Mm-hmm.
But then I did that five times to make it a whole series. And it was a story about this woman who wanted to, her husband dead. So she called on a hit woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to the bar, they seduced him, they killed him, and threw his body off of the edge of the dock and into the water.
And as one does. Go on.
That was the story. And, you know, very classic femme fatale, you know, film noir story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so
Billy invited me to be a part of that.
A classic film noir theatrical production is a little bit similar to the hard edge film noir, but it's also a little Berkeley, so we
mm-hmm.
add, you know, some soft moments in there too.
Okay.
Yeah. So Leah had invited me to be a part of that. Leah's an amazing photographer. That was a few years back, and then it got turned into like a short story coffee table book by Jamie DeWolf, who is the producer of Ruckus and Rumpus Revival. And, you know, through the years, I've just been like, oh, my God, this has to become a musical. Like, we have to do a show.
Okay.
With this, like, concept. And that's kind of, we started then brainstorming it. How can we make it, you know, on this next level? It started as this photography series, and then it went into this awesome book that Jamie wrote called The Black Widow. And now here we are at the Crimson Cabaret, and it has somehow miraculously morphed into a full-blown musical theater circus pole spoken word show.
Wow, that had to have been quite an undertaking. So I'm guessing you all sing? Yes, no, maybe.
I'm the singer of the group.
Okay.
We all dance.
Okay.
I mean, we all dance. I've been doing musical theater my whole life. Leah's been doing dance. Like, we've both been doing dance our whole lives before we ever knew each other. But Flux Vertical Theater, the dance company, is a pole and dance company. So we do pole dance together.
Excellent.
And so most of us in the group either do pole and or burlesque and or classical dance, acting. I'm making them all sing in the show. They all sound great, by the way.
Even
they
Joshua? Joshua, do you sing?
I do not. I do Aww. Not. And that's out of respect and courtesy for all the listeners. I don't think anyone wants to hear my voice.
Yeah, so the show consists of a lot of dramatic scenes, some of which are a little bit more kitschy and old school musical theater style, and some of which are more dramatic and very film noir style.
And I love me some film noir, so, you know, you had me on every level. It's like burlesque, check. Film noir, check. It's like everything about it is just, you know, Joshua's in it, double check, so. So,
and this is a pretty fun show for our audience members, too, because they're invited and encouraged to do their own investigation. When they come in, they can actually open drawers and look through the papers that are set and waiting for them to discover new clues about the show. And then we do have our VIP guests who get, you know, their VIP table comes with drinks, but in order to get your drink, you have to solve all the clues. So there's a lot of participation.
They got
to
work for it
from our audience.
I like that. It'll probably keep a lot of people sober that they have to, you know, use their brain power.
Everyone's a winner, but it's a concept of participation, and we really encourage that in this show. We have a physical comedian who is a part of our show too, who really gets as many people as he can involved in what he's doing, and it's just fun. It's super fun.
And Joshua,
we also have a live pianist. We got a piano for the space, which is very, very exciting for future us as well. So we have an incredible pianist in the show.
What's that pianist's name again?
William C. Note.
Okay. William C. Note. Okay. All right. And because I've known Joshua forever, I need to just ask. So, Joshua, are you the husband that gets killed, or are you something else?
You have to come to find out. Yeah. I mean, I can't say what happens, but, you know, it there could be a lot of things.
Okay. And
no spoilers.
All right. Well, okay. So if no spoilers, then when and where for the show? What time? Where do we get tickets?
So we have we opened this last weekend, and we currently have two more dates this coming Friday and Saturday, the 9th and the 10th. If we happen to sell out. So don't be shy, buy those tickets. If we happen to sell out, I say by midweek we may add a show on the 11th.
Okay, but don't count on it. Let's just like get your tickets because
I don't know.
Me personally, yeah, you like get your tickets because you know it would be annoying to be like,
oh, get tickets because we don't know it's an original show.
Sure.
The score is not original. But everything else in it is original, and the score and the music is very well thought out and well planned. The show was written by myself, Leah, and Jamie DeWolf, and every character in the show has also helped to write, create their own characters and create and choreograph their own solos.
Mm. Okay, I like it. So where can they get tickets?
They can go to our website. It's called fluxverticaltheater.com, and theater is spelled with an R-E at mm-hmm. the end.
Okay.
We decided to be fancy, so it's with an R-E instead of an E-R. And we have a tab that says upcoming events. You can always follow our events there, our new shows will be listed, and the ticket link is right there.
Okay, and
you can also find our ticket links on our Instagram,
which is
well, we have two of them. We have our Flux Vertical Theater with an R-E, and then we have a link tree there, and that it's at the very top of the link tree, or Flux_Theater with an R-E. We also have a link tree on that one.
Okay. And then
we are three businesses in one. So you can also come take classes.
Oh, wow. Well, the next time you guys are on the show, we're going to talk about these classes. Okay. But what times are the shows? Dates and times.
VIP doors are at 7. All other ticket sales doors are at 7:30. Show is at 8 p.m.
Okay. All right. And once more, if people want to learn more about your theater company, how do they go about doing that? Anyone?
FluxVerticalTheater.com or find us on Instagram at FluxVerticalTheater.
All right. Well, Josh, Ms. K, Leah, I want to thank you all for being on the show today, and I look forward to seeing the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out this show. And yes, I have known Joshua pretty much since he was a little kid, and it makes me just super happy that he's involved with that. And I love burlesque, and I love noir, and I love all kinds of spectacle things. So, of course, I have to go and see it. It's just about time for me to ride off into the sunset. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Cher. This, my friends, welcome to burlesque. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Show a little more, show a little less, add a little smile.